You're listening to another episode of the Young Investors Podcast, so sit back and relax as myself, Brandon, and my buddy Hamish discuss the latest in the world of finance and stock market investing. Now, a quick reminder before we get into the podcast is that nothing in this podcast should be taken on as personal financial advice. If you're ever unsure about your finances or investing and you need some help, make sure you reach out to a qualified financial advisor. But with all that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast. Welcome back, everyone. What's going on, Hamish? How you doing?
Hamish? I'm not tired this morning, Hamish.
Feeling good. You got a good night's sleep?
Yeah, I feel like I was just saying off air, I think I got like 3 good nights of sleep in a row, which is apparently it's rare because now I for the first time I woke up this morning, I was like, wow, is this what normal people feel like? Is this like...
You're all energetic.
I'm like, what's going on? I actually woke up and got out of bed. Like, what's going... No, it's been good though. Good to wake up well this morning. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. Yeah, I didn't get a great night's sleep, but that's all right. There is nothing better though than getting a great night's sleep and waking up. Like even the best times I find is when you get a great night's sleep and you is just so well rested. You even wake up before your alarm.
Yeah.
You wake up before your alarm, but you wake up. You're not just like kind of snoozing. You're like, oh, I feel good.
Yeah.
And then you actually get up, you know? I don't know. It kind of makes you feel like, oh, today's going to be really productive. And it almost makes you like more motivated to get stuff done. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't say I have them very often, but
no, honestly, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
And in Canberra, the mornings, like, I think that's the difference between like Canberra and other parts of Australia. Like, the mornings are just so cold.
Yeah.
That it actually, for me anyway, it makes it much harder to get out of bed. Like, I think there's even a difference between it being like 5 degrees outside, air temperature really cold, but like that versus like -1 or -2 is like, it's just that much harder, very difficult. But anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. The cold definitely plays a big role. I can't say it gets to -1 here in Melbourne, but even just compared to the summer, you can kind of tell it's so much easier to wake up in the morning when it's like 18 or 20 outside.
So much easier.
Yeah. We had a little bit of a follow-up from last week. Last week, you were asking people what was the last TV show that they got properly hooked on. And we actually had like quite a bit of feedback on the YouTube version of the podcast. So, I thought we'd go through a couple of them. We had Game of Thrones.
Classic.
That makes perfect sense. I think you mentioned that last week as one of them.
I've actually never seen Game of Thrones, but all of my friends, like, I'm not really a big TV person. I think I said that last week, but all of my friends, I remember when Game of Thrones was coming out, like everybody that I knew was talking Game of Thrones. So
Yeah, I haven't seen it either for some reason. Everybody keeps telling me to watch it, but it's just been one of those ones. I think because it's so long, you just know you're going to,
commitment.
I know I'm going to be like committing to like watching it for like a long time. So I'll watch it eventually though. Everyone keeps telling me to watch it. How I Met Your Mother was a big one there. I have a funny relationship with that show. There was a period of time where for some reason I just was watching it on repeat just constantly. And there was a period where I watched it, I think 8 to 10 times from first episode to last episode, just back to back. And I didn't watch anything else. And I don't know why I did that. I think...
So, you're like the biggest How I Met Your Mother fan in history.
Well, this was a while ago. So, now I've like... For a long time, I could probably have quoted anything in any episode. But I've kind of lost it now. But yeah, I don't know why I did that. It wasn't that good of a show. Like, it was pretty good, but...
Oh, it's one of those things that you can just have on though, you know?
Yeah. I think people, I guess
casual
people have
viewing
that
at its finest.
Yeah, people have that with like The Office or Seinfeld,
like
or something
Friends.
Like that. Yeah, exactly. So
very casual viewing.
We had Mindhunter. It's another one I haven't seen. I've seen a couple episodes. That's a Netflix show.
You hear good reviews about that, but I've not seen it either.
I've heard good reviews. I just haven't gotten hooked into it yet. I watched a couple of episodes and I just didn't hook me in. The Mandalorian, amazing series. I think Mando's classic. That's probably the last one that I got really into.
All right. Yeah.
I think. Breaking Bad and then Scandal as well were a couple others. So
nice.
There you go. That's what shows people are getting hooked into. So
there you go. I can't even remember how that we must have been talking about what were we talking about?
Jeez, I can't even remember now.
What were we talking about?
It's like a week ago.
TV shows that people got hooked onto. I don't even know.
I can't even remember.
Oh, we were talking about Stranger Things at the start of the week. So, that's talking about what was the other show? Stranger Things and Obi-Wan. Yeah, that's right.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Oh, very good. Thanks for sending in
Guys.
your shows, guys. That was interesting. All right, today. Oh, golly gee.
Oh boy.
Inflation. Here we go.
Don't check your portfolios, guys.
yeah. Inflation, rate hikes. I've got an interesting thing about Warren Buffett. I watched a Warren Buffett lecture the other day, which kind of feeds into investing during bad market times. We've got Australia minimum wage rise, bit of a Bitcoin story as well, which you'll take us through. And we'll talk about Michael Burry as well. Just made a video on Michael Burry, kind of summarizing what he's been saying over the past month because it's kind of coming true right now. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. But Hamish, please remind me, who is the sponsor of this show?
Hang on, I've got it here. It's a company called ShareSite.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so apparently it's some kind of application that you can use to... So ShareSite, everybody. It's an application you can use basically to track the performance of your portfolio. You can bring in all of your trades either automatically by connecting your broker. You can connect multiple brokers as well. So if you have you do trades in multiple accounts, you can kind of consolidate it all into one ShareSite account, and it will track all of your gains and losses in your portfolio. Probably some losses over the past week, I would imagine. capital gains, dividends. Sorry about that. That's a bit too soon. dividend reinvestment plans, it will do those calculations for you. Currency gains, if you're buying shares internationally or hold foreign currencies, that's a big one. I checked mine just before, and between the Australian and the US dollar over the past 6 months, there's been a 4% positive swing for Australians investing in the US. So that's kind it's a big deal. It's a 4% difference that you might not be tracking if you're not tracking the currency gains in your portfolio. And it can certainly go the other way as well. So you want to have an accurate snapshot of what your return is, including those currency fluctuations. And then you can also use it for when it comes to tax time, which is upon us for Australians and New Zealanders. ShareSite generates up to 12 different reports that can be used to track the performance of your portfolio and use the tax time to work out things such as capital gains, dividend income, and more. At the moment, you can try ShareSite for free by heading over to ShareSite.com/young investors. That's SiteSpot, SIGHT, ShareSite.com/young investors. So use that link, sign up to a free plan, track up to 10 holdings for as long as you want, or you can also get 4 months off a premium plan if you use that link, 4 months off a yearly subscription. So go check it out if you're interested. And thanks to everyone who has used that link to sign up to ShareSite, even for a free account. And you know, if at some point in the future you sign up to a premium account, that'll still help to support this podcast. So thanks, everybody. Mm.
All right, let's talk about us. Sorry to sound like a broken record. At this point, I mean, we have to talk about it because it's the biggest, you know, discussion point in markets and economics at the moment. But we sound like flipping broken records at this point. But we've got to cover it because this is getting pretty dire. This is getting pretty ridiculous. US inflation, Hamish, take us through. When do we get the data?
This actually came out on Thursday last week or Friday. Oh, no, sorry. Actually, no, it was on Saturday. It was my birthday. I think I said on the podcast.
Happy birthday, mate. Oh, happy birthday.
Thank you.
How old are you?
I'm 24. So
24.
Yeah. I'm still on the good side of 25. So
you are on the, I'm on the bad side. I'm 27. So yeah, no, happy birthday. Just to derail the podcast for a bit, did you do anything for your birthday?
Just caught up with some friends on Friday. So nothing too crazy.
Do you still get presents or nah, that time's over?
Yeah, some small presents from family, but nothing crazy.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Oh, happy birthday. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
back to inflation.
Yeah, so my birthday gift from the Federal Reserve was the inflation data. So this is a little bit old, of course. You guys have seen this for a few days, but just to give you some details on it, the headline number, of course, was 8.6% annual US inflation, up from 8.3% recorded last month and the 8.5% recorded the month before. So, of course, last month was a little bit of a dip and everyone was like, it's peaked. it's peaked, everyone.
Yeah.
It's on the way down.
Going back down.
And of course,
back down to 2%, mate.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Love that. I mean, we saw the same thing last year when it went to like 5.5%. And then it went down slightly for like 2 months or something.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, oh, this is it. Jerome Powell decided not to update his inflation target, left it at 2%. He was like, here we go. Well, the rest of the year, we're going from 5% straight down. And no, it didn't happen. But yeah, so 8.6%. The monthly increase is kind of crazy. 1%, which is... Yeah, that's half of the annual target. So yeah, 1%, massive. The second highest month-over-month increase after March 2022, which was, of course, just a couple of months ago. So
that's 12% annualized.
12%, yeah, right.
Annualized. Well, yeah.
Well, even more than that as well if you compound it. So 12 point something percent. So yeah, it's a pretty high pace. Year to date is always a fun one. Inflation is 3.95%. So basically at 4% inflation for the year. And how many months are we in? What are we up to now? 5 months?
This is data for last month, so it would have been five.
So we've had 5 months, we're at 4%. So we're basically tracking, on target for what the annual rate is at the moment, which is about 8%. So that was interesting. Jerome Powell, he has updated his inflation expectation. He's done it. For so long, he
2.1%?
Yeah, he's lowered it. No.
It was 2.4, wasn't it? Yeah.
It was 2.4.
2.4 to 2.5?
Yeah, yeah. No, but so at the start of the year, he said 2022 inflation would be 2.4%. And he left it at that up until this month. So he was really hopeful for a long time. Now, less so. He's a little bit more realistic now. He's at 4.3%. So. How we're going to get to 4.3% when we're at 3.95 in the first 5 months, I don't know, but I don't expect anybody to understand the genius behind Jerome Powell's inflation projections.
It's just not right, is it?
It is kind of funny though. I laughed out loud a little bit when he said 4.3% because we're at 4%. Like, yeah. I just don't understand.
He's just saying, it's going to stop now.
It's just like that would be the most wrong number you could predict. Yeah. Like, I will bet anything that, well, I shouldn't say that. Get to the end of the year and I'll eat my words, but
yeah.
I would be extremely surprised if 4.3% is where we finish up for the end of the year.
It's just not going to be. That's just not it. That's, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, why wouldn't you at least just like, if you want to be conservative, sure, be conservative, but don't be like, don't say a figure that's just obviously not correct. You know, I mean, if we're at, what are we now? 3.95 and it's going to get to 4.3. That's just not going to happen.
Yeah. It would have
We've to, still got yeah. seven months of reporting
yeah.
of this figure to go.
Yeah. There would have to be some serious kind of deflation. And I guess it's possible that that comes from the energy market, which has been extremely inflated. Possibly that some of that supply side shock is relieved. And that actually causes a decline in energy, bringing everything, back down. But, we'll see what happens. In terms of energy, it was the biggest driver, again, of inflation. Fuel oil was the biggest single increase, which was 16.9% month over month. The annual increase in fuel oil is 106.7%. It's literally doubled in price. And, you know, everyone's kind of seen that across the economy, and it's, you know, directly in petrol and gasoline prices. But it also it affects everything, right? It affects the costs of food and pretty much everything in manufacturing. So
just out of curiosity, are fuel prices over $2 a litre where you are?
We're at about $2.20, $2.30, $2.30.
Wow.
Yeah. How about yourself? Canberra normally has expensive petrol, right?
Yeah, I think we're at like $2.10 or something, somewhere around there. I don't know, because not to sound like on my high horse or anything, but it doesn't really affect me too much anymore.
No.
But I do, occasionally I'll like ride past a servo and I just notice that... notice the prices, but yeah, so I think it's still about $2.10. Crazy though. Crazy. Yeah.
We are a bit shielded from it because you work from your office, but you don't drive. And I don't go anywhere. I don't leave my house. for months on end. So we're a bit shielded, but you do kind of, I definitely feel bad for you know, everyone who has to, you know, drive to work, especially people have to commute hours.
Yeah.
And they're talking about, you know, maybe, you know, quite a significant increase in their, even in just the weekly fuel kind of, or petrol bill, which is, yeah, so that's been a tough one. Core inflation, if we exclude energy and food, was still up quite a lot. The year-over-year rate was 6% and the month-over-month was 0.6. So again, energy has been a big driver of inflation, but it's not the whole story. There's definitely other elements, particularly in core inflation, that are driving it. And the biggest increases were all related to vehicles. So new vehicles, used vehicles, and transportation services were the three biggest drivers of core inflation.
Right.
So yeah, that's kind of the inflation data. And I guess we'll just keep going on, because last night we got to hear from Jerome. Did you have something to say on that? Or
no, I was just going to say, yeah, this is the more interesting stuff. Like, the inflation data is really just a number, but the interesting thing is what is being done about the inflation. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So we got the Fed Reserve's meeting, Jerome Powell, of course, head of the Federal Reserve. He also came out and did kind of a speech, an interview, answered questions and that sort of thing. Press conference, that's right. So he kind of gave us a bit of, shedded a bit of color on the decision. But the decision at the end was at 75 basis points or 0.75% increase in the federal funds rate. And that was compared to the 50 basis points that he said he was going to do in this meeting last month, if that makes sense.
Right.
So last month they did a 50 basis point. And then they said next month will be 50 basis points. Because inflation has continued to surge, they decided to do 75 basis points. It's the highest hike since 1994. So it is kind of considerable. And it brings the federal funds rate to 1.6%.
Right.
Basically doubling the federal funds rate.
Yeah.
In one meeting. So even though it's only 0.75% in the scheme of things, it's big when you compare it to where rates were just a few months ago.
But then again, rates were very close to zero. So any kind of movement looks like
oh my God.
Yeah.
400% increase.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And what rates have gone to like 4%, you know? Yeah. So, not surprised. You were tipping like, do they just go a whole percentage point? Do they just?
I thought they might.
They just slap it on.
Well,
why not? Yeah. How many times? I forget how many times the Fed meets per year, because they just do these updates after they meet, right?
Yeah, it's every month, but there's a couple of months where they take a break.
It's like 10 times a year or something.
Yeah, it's something like that.
But
yeah,
still. So they've still got, even though this is, it seems small, it's like 0.75%. Is that really going to do anything? They do have like 10 opportunities throughout the year to do the same thing. So
yeah.
I think that this is a start. I think it'll again, I don't know, but I think it's going up a lot more.
Yeah.
That's my prediction.
Yeah. So the Fed also came out and said where they expect rates to be at the end of the year. So what are they expecting to do in terms of continued hikes? They're expecting rates to be at 3.4% by the end of the year. So it's basically another 2%. You could really chalk that up to four more 50 basis point hikes is currently the expectation. That would be four out of, I think, five or six meetings that are left for the year. He also said, but they are open to doing a 75 basis point rise again if it's necessary. So I think if inflation continues to surge, if it goes into the 9% range next month, then it's very likely we'll see another 75 basis point again.
I was looking at just to butt in. You remember how you were talking a while back about the old like pre-1980s method of calculating inflation, and how if you, like, the last time we saw massive inflation was 1980, I think it was 15%.
Yeah.
But through the years, the way they measure the inflation has changed. So it's actually, the inflation we see now is actually understated versus that old method. I looked it up. I looked at the chart of the old method, and
it's,
I think,
good.
We're up to like 17%, 17% inflation by that same method that was used back when inflation was 15% back in the 1980.
Yeah.
So we're really, even though they say, we haven't quite gotten back to 15%, use the same methodology, we're actually worse right now than 1980.
Yeah, and I think that's why so many people struggle to believe that 75 basis point increase is enough. I mean,
what did Paul Volcker do? He put rates up to 20%.
Yeah, 19% was the highest, and there were some big jumps. If you look at the chart, it's quite steep at certain times. It was still gradual over time. It has to be, but there were some big there were big increases in there. So yeah, I mean, even if you, it's just hard to believe that even if you take the 8.6% rate at face value, it's hard to believe that. It's hard to believe that a couple percent in interest rate increases is going to be enough, but it's, we'll see.
We'll see. They're going to keep going. What they're doing now is they're saying, okay, inflation, we have to stop it. So I would imagine that they will keep going until it is stopped. I mean, if interest rates go up to like 3%, 4%, 5%, and we're not seeing inflation come down considerably from that, 8% range, I don't think they're just going to stop and go, okay, we'll just keep rates at 4% and we'll keep inflation 8%. We tried. No. I mean, they're going to keep the objective here is to get inflation back down. So they will keep pushing higher and higher until it happens, I would imagine.
Absolutely. There's no question about that they'll continue to regularly push. It's just a question, I think, of how long does it take? Like some people really want, I saw some stuff on Twitter. People were saying, let's just do a 300 basis point.
Like, honestly.
And obviously that would cripple. That's not something you can do. You can't do that. But
you could in the 1980s, couldn't you? But yeah, very hard to do like politically, socioeconomically or all that kind of thing today.
Yeah. But I think you could do that from a higher federal funds rate base. If the rates were at 5% going to 8%,
right,
it's not as bad as going from 1 to 4, if that makes sense, because that's like a 3x increase in the rate. And for some
I was just going to say my personal opinion, and this is the way I approach most tasks. Maybe people are different, but I'm always like a nip it in the bud kind of person.
Yeah.
Like, okay, there's a problem, fix the problem. Just do it. Just do it right now, I'm not someone that's just like, I'll chip away at it. I'm just like, no, just do it. And that's all. Yeah. That's just like who I am. So,
because I mean,
maybe people don't feel the same way.
No, well, the longer that it goes on, there's just going to be more pain. Especially
and if that's Paul Volcker. He had like big cojones back in the day. Cause he like, again, he caused a recession.
Yeah.
But he said, you know what? Let's just do it. Let's get it done. He came in, he acted decisively, rates went up massively, but inflation came down. Problem solved. I mean, yes, recession, not a great outcome, but I mean, that's kind of unavoidable when you're trying to fix something like this.
Yeah.
But, he acted decisively and it worked. But anyway, sorry, I did cut you off there.
No, you're fine. So basically, just to continue on, so they're expecting 7 rate hikes in total now by the end of the year. At the start, they expected 3 25 basis point increases. So they're well beyond that now. I had a quick look at our predictions because we made some predictions at the start of the year. We both predicted that there would be more than 3 25 basis point hikes, but I was actually way off. You were very close. We're still halfway through the year.
Oh, really?
I expected 20%. A total of 1% increases, so about 4 rate hikes, which looks like that's probably not going to be very accurate. You said two things. One you said is it's going to be more than 0.75%, but then straight after that you said you wouldn't be surprised if the rate ends at the end of the year at 3 to 4%, which is the current expectation. So
there you go.
You're bang on at the moment.
Can we update that? I'm going to say I wouldn't be surprised. I'll guess 3 to 4%, like I said back then, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's more like 6 or 7%.
Yeah, I'll just keep moving it up. Yeah, I definitely would say that 4% is very, very likely now. And I would probably say the same as you. I wouldn't be surprised if it was as high as 5, but yeah.
We'll see.
If it's above 5, I would be... I wouldn't be surprised because in a way, but I would also be kind of shocked because I think the market will react so violently to that. I think we'll be sitting at the end of the year and yeah, it'll be a very interesting situation in the markets, I think, if that's the case. But, yeah, is there anything else I had to say? Yeah, he just had a couple of comments. He said a soft landing may not be possible. So, he said, which he previously thought was something that they could achieve. He said, so a soft landing is really just getting back to 2% inflation while keeping the labor market strong. And it's quite challenging to accomplish that right now for a couple of reasons. He also noted that with a tight labor market, pushing up wages, avoiding a recession that often follows aggressive policy tightening will be a challenge. So he's just preparing everyone for the reality that we're probably headed for a recession.
All right. Is that everything?
That's everything. Cheery right, way to start the morning.
Sorry. Yeah, exactly. I thought on that topic, actually, it's kind of interesting. Obviously, as a response to what's been going on macroeconomics, we've seen the market fall off a cliff, really, 2022. I think we're down over 20% year to date. And we've lost, I think, 8% in the past 5 trading days.
Yeah.
So we had a bit of a recovery. I think it was like a 6% recovery and then whoosh, gone straight away. But I just wanted to bring up a really good Warren Buffett. It's not an interview. It's a lecture, a Warren Buffett lecture that I had watched at some point in the past, but I actually watched it again yesterday. And the reason I bring this up is because there's a lot of like really solid takeaways you can take for investing in times of like quite bad market performance and market volatility. So I'll let you guys know that if you wanted to actually watch the lecture, it's like an hour, just over an hour long. Definitely recommend you watch it. It's called, so search on YouTube, Warren Buffett, Chairman, Berkshire Hathaway Investment Group, Terry Leadership Speaker Series. It's from a long time ago, but I just thought I'd watch it. I had a bit of time, so just watched it yesterday. And there are some really good points. So I thought that I'd just quickly go through five takeaways that I took out of it that really help almost just like calm you down and guide you on the right path with your investing during like a market crash. So the first one that was very obvious, and he actually stated this explicitly, don't panic sell because the market is dropping. He used the classic Mr. Market analogy, Ben Graham's Mr. Market analogy, you know, basically like if you have a nosy neighbor and he pops his head, you know, over the fence every day and he gives you a price that he wants to buy your house for. You know, one day it's like $700,000, one day it's $650,000, and then one day he's like really just sad and depressed and he thinks that, you know, the housing market's going to fall off a cliff at some point in the future and he comes through and he offers you like $200,000 for your house. It's like, what would you say to him? Are you going to sell your house to him? Like, absolutely not. Yeah. Like, no way. But that's exactly what happens in stock market crashes in the stock market. People, the panic sell. They're like, oh my God, the price is falling, so I got to sell.
Yeah, and it's the people who panic are the people who don't understand what they're holding. I spoke about this in a video, how if someone comes and offers you a price to sell your business or something at a lower price than what you paid for, if you're not confident in the price that you paid, then you're going to panic and think, oh, is this person right and I'm wrong? Whereas if you're confident in your analysis or you're just index investing, so you don't even need to worry about it, then you're not going to care. You're just going to think it's some lunatic who's panicking among everything that's happening. So,
I'm glad you bring that up because that's actually another takeaway that he talks about a lot in that interview is making sure in times of market volatility, the market's dropping like a brick, make sure you understand what you hold or what you're looking to buy. He basically spent quite a chunk of this interview or of this lecture talking about just like just do not mess with the cheap companies that you don't understand. You know, even if your neighbor just bought this amazing like life insurance company because it's just dropped, you know, 80% and it looks super cheap, you know, don't feel as though you have to buy that company as well. Because if you were, and the reasoning behind this is if you were to just be like, oh, that went down 80%, it'll come back. Sure, I'll buy it. Life insurance. Know nothing about life insurance. What happens in a market crash if it goes down another 30%? what do you do? You don't know what to do. Like, should you sell? Is this like what if you saw Bear going down in 2008, didn't know a thing about banks, investment bank, nothing like that, and you're like, oh, look at this deal. It looks so cheap. I mean, that wouldn't have worked out very well for you, right?
No.
So that was another a big point that I'm glad you brought up, was to understand the business. So we've got don't panic sell because the market's dropping. Make sure you understand what you're buying. He also took a while to talk about, you know, taking your opportunities. So he pointed out, and this is something that I really like to think about, market crashes don't come along very often. They are actually like the big ones. You get 10% drop-offs here and there, but the big ones are very infrequent.
Yeah.
And Buffett spoke at length about how his biggest mistakes in his investing career have been mistakes of omission, of not acting, of not doing something. And he says, you know, if you want to get rich and make money in life, when you're presented with big opportunities, you have to seize them, and you have to seize them in a big way. That's the other thing he said. So I thought that's very, because I think, like, if you think about it, the last big market crash, you could call 2020 a big market crash, I guess, but really the last big one that made everything cheap was 2008. That's a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah. And that's generally what it is. It's like 5 to 8 years, I think, is the actual average between big crashes or in between recessions that kind of go alongside a big crash. So yeah, it's usually a long time. It's very unique that we've seen 20+% drops in the space of a couple of years. It's a very unique situation. It's really, really what happened was the market collapsed during the pandemic, and then the Fed's action with quantitative easing basically just prolonged this recession, which probably would have happened immediately during the pandemic if there wasn't stimulus. It's kind of like they just propped up the market for just a little bit for like, what, a year and a half. And then it all came flooding out as soon as the stimulus was dropped. So it's kind of all in the same. But it presented an interesting opportunity for people, I think especially young people, to see how it feels to go through the process in 2020 where there wasn't too much of a consequence if you stayed the course because things came back really quickly. That's not typical, right? All the other recessions and crashes we've seen, it takes years for stocks to come back. So we shouldn't expect, you know, what happened in 2020 to happen over again. But you kind of got a bit of a taster if that was your first big crash. So
yeah.
So very interesting.
Don't panic sell because the market's dropping. Understand the business. Take your opportunities when you're presented with them. The other two that I took out of it, the first one was the classic Buffett, you know, this is Buffett's contribution to the value investing approach. In a market crash, list your watch list by quality of business, not by how much it's fallen. This is like classic Warren Buffett, buy a great business at a fair price as opposed to buying a mediocre business at a bargain price. It's much better to, because again, this will feed into the next thing I talk about. What we want is we want to be on board for a long time. I mean, Ben Graham was all about the cigar butts, like they're crappy businesses, but they got one last puff because they're so cheap. They got one last puff. You take the puff, it's disgusting, but it's free. Whereas Warren Buffett's more about, okay, no, I want to be aboard the train for 10 years and I want to let this company, you know, compound internally because it's well managed and it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And that over time is a much better strategy than just trying to quickly move on from cigar butt to cigar butt. So he just reinforced that, you know, when the market crashes, you're going to get a lot of very cheap companies. But a lot of the times, the very cheap companies can be very cheap for a reason because they're a bear or a Lehman or whatever, and they're about to, you know, bite the bullet, even if they might have one last puff. So instead, look at the great companies in market crashes.
Yeah. When everything's coming down, I'm always looking. The first place I look is the businesses that I already own because they're the ones that I know the most well. And as a result, if they're cheap again, that's where I would feel the most confident. But yeah, even on a watch list of businesses that you don't own, there's clearly some that you know really, really well. You're very confident in that they're great businesses. And then there'll be ones that are still great companies, but you don't know them as well. So yeah, ranking them yeah, I guess ranking them in terms of quality and an element of that is you know how much time I guess you've spent on learning about those businesses. So yep. Yeah, super important.
And then the last one was just very briefly. This is a key feature of every Buffett talk. Stay focused on the long term. He spoke about, you know, just like short term noise gets in the way and investing can be difficult in market crashes. But if you always go in thinking that, no, the money that I put into the market is going to stay into the market for at least 10 years. Like I'm not even going to think about it for 10 years. I won't need that money. I won't need to pay rent with that money. You know, I'm investing money I don't need. I'm going to stay along for the ride because I want to compound my money for the long term. Then that just makes investing in any market conditions like a lot better. It makes investing in high market conditions better because you've got a very long-term horizon. Like who cares if the market falls off a cliff? It also makes, you know, investing in market crashes much easier because it's like, everything's, you know, bottoming around me. This is horrible, but it's like, yes, all right. I'm in good companies, a lot of time.
Yeah.
This will blow over. Yeah. So that was the last thing.
Yeah, if you're in companies that have no real risk of going out of business during weak economic conditions and it's a business that has something great that people will come back to, maybe at the moment people are going to save some money and let's say discretionary purchases, maybe they're not going to buy that new car or spend on this holiday. But if the business has something unique and that's special and that customers desire, then after economic conditions get good again, people will come back to that business. So those are really the two, you know, two of the core elements. Can it survive through a period of pain, an extended period of pain? And will customers come back or will they, you know, have many other choices that they may or may not come back to this specific business? And if that's the case, if it is one of those businesses, then yeah, you can just have a long-term view. You don't need to worry about the short term. It really doesn't matter. So
it doesn't matter. You're right.
It doesn't matter.
So they are the five takeaways that I took out of this Warren Buffett talk. Again, if you wanted to watch it, YouTube it, Warren Buffett, Chairman, Berkshire Hathaway Investment Group, Terry Leadership Speaker Series.
Yeah.
And I hope you enjoy it. I think it's an hour well spent. It's an hour well spent. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, Hamish.
I want to take us through this Bitcoin story because this is something that just popped up. I want to take us through this because it's very funny and it's very short. It's just something I saw on Twitter. I've been as I said a couple of times, I've been diving into the Twitter world and man, it is hilarious.
They're so good. Crushed right now.
I think I just missed out. I think what Twitter has is there's so much people talking about finance on there. There's just so much. I don't know. It's just a good like casual place to talk about finance, I think. And it's a lot of fun. I don't know. I didn't really get into Twitter for a long time. Now I'm investing with Tom got me into it. So
Bitcoin Twitter is looking grim right now.
Yeah, Bitcoin Twitter is great. Oh, it's a lot of fun at the moment.
I mean, how many times have you heard that Bitcoin will help protect you against crashes in the stock market?
It's inflation. It's an inflation hedge.
It's a store
of value, right?
How many times have you heard that?
So how
dramatically incorrect is that playing out right now?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Let me get the peak to trough of Bitcoin because I haven't looked, but it's like down like 70% or something.
It's down a long, long way.
Get it in US and really, dollars.
Most of the people that bought Bitcoin would be anticipating that in these conditions, Bitcoin would be surging higher and higher and higher.
Yeah.
People move away from US dollars and into Bitcoin.
Yeah. And that's definitely not playing out.
No,
not at all. So it was $68,000 at its peak in November last year. And now it's at 22,000. So down 66%. It's been quite dramatic, but one thing I saw that popped up on my Twitter was a CNBC interview from Michael Saylor, who's the founder of MicroStrategy. MicroStrategy is one of the few companies that absolutely plowed money into Bitcoin. It was MicroStrategy, Tesla, and then Block, I guess, were the three that put like a considerable amount of money into.
Michael Saylor, he just wanted to turn his entire his company's balance sheet to be Bitcoin. That like, no, actually, he's like said
I,
that.
I, I'm aware of that now. I didn't know that he was this intense on Bitcoin until I heard a quote, which I'll run through as well. But yeah, he's intensely on Bitcoin. So much so that I genuinely thought some of the stuff he was saying was a joke, like that it was satire. Right. So yeah, anyway, his company MicroStrategy at the moment holds about 129,000 Bitcoin. At an average price of $30,000 per coin, which is about $4 billion, now worth $2.9 billion. So they've lost about $1 billion on Bitcoin so far. And there's this interview floating around from last year when Bitcoin was $56,000 a coin. Now it's at 22, so it's more than 50% dropped from this point. And this is the quote. This is a direct quote from this interview.
Right.
The only use of time is how do I buy more Bitcoin? Take all of your money and buy Bitcoin. Then take all your time and figure out how to borrow more money to buy Bitcoin. Then take all your time and figure out what you can sell to buy more Bitcoin. And if you absolutely love the thing that you don't want to sell, go mortgage your house and buy Bitcoin. And he said that in two different interviews. So this wasn't just like one interview. I thought maybe, you know, this guy's just speaking in hyperbole. Like he's just saying, he's basically just saying Bitcoin's great. But he said this in two different interviews where he said, take a draw down credit line on your house. Like he said that.
Let's just pump it, boys.
It's just like, because that's always been a joke of mine. It's like, yeah, go mortgage your house, buy cryptocurrency. Like it's, but I can't believe there's actually people.
He's like full on serious.
Oh my goodness. And, yeah, so obviously he's coming out today to try and say Bitcoin's still great even though it's getting crushed. In an interview, he was asked about why he thinks Bitcoin is still a good investment, and he basically said, "We back tested everything before buying our stake, and Bitcoin has outperformed every other asset over 2-4 year periods or even longer periods. So essentially, his reasoning for buying is that it's the best performing asset." Recently, which is kind of interesting.
Flawless.
Yeah, he was asked.
Flawless reasoning.
Yeah, exactly. That's just, I think Warren Buffett said that once, right? The best performing asset will continue to be the best performing asset. I think that's a quote from Buffett.
I think so.
Maybe it's Benjamin Graham. Yeah.
If it goes up, it will continue to go up.
Yeah. Yeah. Extrapolate the recent past into the future. I think that's another one.
That's a good one. but not if it goes down. No, because it'll just come back up. So,
correct. Yes. Yeah. So if it's a that's actually what he said. That's actually what he said. He said if your time horizon is 1 month, then it's going to be volatile. But yeah, that's just a blip. If you look over a 2 or 4 year period, Bitcoin has beaten everything. So yeah, you're right. If it's a little blip, even if it's a 70% blip, it's okay. He said he was asked if he's buying more. He said, if your time horizon is 10 years, it's a risk-off store of value. He said, Bitcoin is on sale and it's absolutely a buy right now. Although he actually kind of dodged the actual question, which was, are you buying more right now? So that was the question. And he kind of went on this rant
about- Well, he can't. He's already mortgaged his house. He's already-
Well, that's the thing. He has-
He's got 25 credit cards. He's got margin account. He's leveraged to the high. Well, he can't get any more.
Yeah, he can't. He's actually taken a huge amount of debt out through the company for this. I think he was asked about whether he was going to get a margin call because everyone's kind of joking that he's going to get a margin call. He said no because he only has- a $200 million loan that's that could get a margin call. The rest is unsecured, I believe. So only a portion of the debt, at least this is what he says. So take it with a pinch of salt. But he said only a portion of the debt could actually get a margin call given the decline in Bitcoin. Only that is secured against the Bitcoin. Everything else is, I guess, unsecured or secured against other assets in their business. So there you go. But yeah, man, it's that's a whole rabbit hole I went down. I didn't know this guy. Well, I knew he existed, but I didn't know he was this intense.
I've seen a couple of his interviews before. It's just like there's no other. I like listening to people that can battle both ways. They can say, here are the pros, here are the cons, here are the risks, here are the benefits, and this is why I sit on this side of the coin, whichever side that is. But I like people that have that kind of back and forth in their own head, that kind of, what's my hypothesis? You know, what's the antithesis? And kind of battle it out like that. But this guy is just like, no. There's nothing. There's no downsides to Bitcoin. There's no. It's like you just you can't even consider the counter argument kind of thing.
Do you reckon he actually believes that?
Like, I don't know. I don't know him well enough. But I couldn't comment. But
yeah.
Maybe, I mean, yeah.
It's just crazy. I mean, if, to do that with anything, even an individual business, is to just go all in on it, and even to suggest going in debt is a crazy, it's a crazy strategy. So, yeah, well, I guess time will tell. Maybe he's going to be a genius. He's certainly like, he's all in on his conviction. So, if he's right, he looks like a genius. If he's wrong, he looks like an absolute delusional fool. But like, there's no in between. There's not like, if you have like 5% of your portfolio in Bitcoin and it goes to zero, you can be like, yeah, look, I thought maybe it could go up. And if it goes up a ton, you can go, yeah, well, I put a bit in and, you know, rocketed. But he's either like going to be laughed at for the rest of time, or like he's our savior.
Like, yeah. It's one or the other.
Yeah. Anyway, that's all I had on that. So I just wanted to check that in.
Do you want to talk about the raise the minimum wage? That was quite interesting. I saw that the other... When was that? Was actually quite recently.
Yeah, that was this week. So, this is an Australian back home story where we saw a 5.2% increase in the minimum wage. So, that's a sizable increase.
That's quite a chunk, yeah. It's so not bad.
Yeah, so the hourly base rate goes from $20.33 to $21.38 per hour. The change will affect 2.7 million Australians, and it comes after Australia just recorded 5.1% inflation. So it's basically in line with the last year's inflation, slightly above. I think it's the first increase in the minimum wage in quite a few years. So I think it's been a long time coming for that increase. Just to give you the kind of the two sides of the coin, it's one of those topics where there's quite a lot of division on whether this is good, particularly given the economic conditions that are going on at the moment. Sally McManus, the head of the Australian Council of Trade Unions, said the decision is one that is reasonable and is fair. She went on to say, it means that for low-paid workers, they will have a better ability to pay rent and pay groceries and to pay for energy bills as well. And then on the other side, the Australian Chamber of Commerce warned the decision would put businesses under more stress. A spokesperson said, this will add $7.9 billion in costs to the affected businesses over the year ahead. So that will be a very, very considerable burden on those businesses. Those businesses will either have to take to the bottom line or pass it on to their customers. I thought...
Or do layoffs.
Yeah, well, exactly. And
here's a rise to the minimum wage. Oh, by the way, you don't have a job anymore.
Yeah, and we're going to cut 5% of staff. 5.2% of staff.
This is economics. This is just, I'm not having a laugh. I'm not trying to take a side here, but this is just economics. One thing affects another thing, which affects another thing. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, I thought we could take this opportunity just for a couple of minutes to talk about just the issue in general, because it is a very, it's not something where the science is out on the minimum wage in general, and also just minimum wage increases. And at the core of it, the question is, do these increases cause more inflation, which is why it's quite divisive at the moment, because on one hand you have people suggesting that it certainly does help lower income workers to pay for the bills more easily and to kind of catch up a little bit from inflation. And on the other side, you have the question as to is it exacerbating the inflation that we're seeing.
Yeah, so, if businesses just pass on the cost increase to their customers, then it's like, well, the consumers are getting a pay rise and the consumers are paying more.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly not settled. I'll give you the two points of view. So, I think the most popular and mainstream economic view. So, this is kind of the mainstream economic view, but it's not by an overwhelming majority. There's certainly another view that is very, very popular that I'll talk about in a second. But the kind of the mainstream view is that minimum wage increases do drive cost push inflation. So, this is the type of inflation we've been talking a lot about, because we've seen the oil shock, we've seen shipping bottlenecks, the Shanghai lockdowns causing shipping trouble and manufacturing trouble, the chip shortages. All of these things are essentially sudden increases in costs for businesses that are then passed on to customers in the form of higher prices causing inflation. So we've seen that with a number of other types of expenses on the supply side for businesses. So one view on minimum wage increases is that it just drives higher labor costs, which is then passed on in the form of high inflation. So that's kind of one point of view. The other mainstream point of view is that essentially the cost push inflation theory makes sense on paper. And this is what we talk a lot about economics is in a vacuum, in a nice, simple environment, in mathematics, it's very easily laid out. You can look at how the economic machine works. But in practice, the evidence for whether some of these theories actually play out is kind of murky. So there was researchers from Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. They examined the effect of prices on minimum wage increases in various states in the US from 1978 through to 2015. And what they found was wage price elasticities are notably lower than reported in previous work. We find price growth for consumer goods of 0.36% for every 10% increase in the minimum wage. So they're essentially, their finding was that there was an increase in prices on average from minimum wage increases, but it's a fraction of the increase relative to the minimum wage increases. So only a small amount is passed on to the customer. Mm. The rest is kind of taken on by the business. And there's really two possible explanations for this as to why this effect actually happens in practice. One is that people become more productive after the wage increase. So people work harder and that's deflationary. So they're more productive. They produce more products and services for business. And the other possibility, and likely both of these play a role, is employers laying off work to reduce costs rather than increasing prices, which is also deflationary. So that's kind of what's seen in practice. And I think just to give like a bottom line on both of those perspectives, economics is extremely messy and there's always multiple things happening at once. So when there's a minimum wage increase, there's often other things that are happening that mean you can't really just see a direct cause and effect of the minimum wage increase or tax changes is a big one as well. A lot of people look back at past periods and say, oh, tax cuts didn't do this or tax increases didn't do that. But there's always other things going on. To even just take the current minimum wage increase, how do you really differentiate what inflation is being driven by, if any, by the minimum wage increase and what's being driven by other factors that we're seeing right now, a lot of inflationary factors. So I think the theory is always helpful to understand how the machine works, but it only takes you so far. And in reality, there's just so many factors that go into whether something is overall positive or negative for the economy. But it's certainly interesting. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. There's so many factors at play. You can't just be like, oh, if we do that, then that will happen. Yeah. I mean, you know, it might, you could do something in economics and it could have, that could actually have the desired outcome, but you never actually see that desired outcome in the statistics because something else in economics has affected that desired outcome and dragged it the other way.
Yeah.
So, it is messy, but I can understand how it could go both ways.
Yeah.
But I certainly can't. I'm macroeconomics, everybody. Economics is my extensive knowledge and history of study in the field of economics.
All I would say for people is just be careful listening to people who are just purely running their ideas on the theory because the theory doesn't always play out in
they got some sort of agenda or something.
It is what it is. And it happens on both sides. You know, there's people who on the other side as well, who just think regardless of what the economic impact is, it should be done. Both of those things are incorrect. You need to consider a lot of factors. So,
You know, if inflation's gone up by 5.1% in the past year, then I think fair enough that we raise the minimum wage by 5.2%. You know, we at least cover that inflation. Otherwise, it's just I'm like, with you. Suckers.
Yeah.
cop it. Everything's more expensive and you have not any more money than you had last year.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I think overall it's a good thing. Well overdue as well anyway, so.
Yeah.
All right. What have we
should
got?
Should we do some Q&A?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'll do some Q&A.
I mean, we've only got like 5 minutes left. I might cover Michael Burry next week, but essentially I just made a video on it. So if you're interested in hearing about Michael Burry, then just head over to my channel and just watch that video. But I want to get – we'll do some Q&A. That'll nicely round out the hour.
All right.
Hamish, you found one?
Yeah, I'll ask you this one.
Sure.
Hey, guys, welcome back. Been following for a while and love both your content and the podcast. Thank you. Appreciate it. Tom is new on my list as well. I was wondering if you know any podcasts about the ASX. I live here and don't follow much on that side.
I don't listen to too many ASX-related podcasts, honestly. There's one good one, Equity Mates. I listen to their stuff sometimes. They're very good. Their growth over the past, just on a side note, their growth has been unbelievable. I was talking to Bryce the other day, who's one of the hosts of Equity Mates. They've like turned their little podcast in this fully fledged like podcast network. It's just amazing what they've done, honestly.
It's crazy.
Yeah, so Equity Mates is a good one. And also I listen to the work that Ted Richards does, but because we've got we've kind of got a connection there that we did the podcast back with him. He runs the Richards Report and he now works for Wilson's Advisory. He does the podcast there called Invest at Best. But I like his content. He's got a good style and I like listening to what he puts out. But honestly, there's probably heaps of good ones, but it's just not really what I listen to. I'm just not like I am an Australian and I live in Australia, but I'm just not thrilled with the ASX.
Yeah.
I just don't find it particularly interesting.
Yeah.
The companies in my circle of competence just aren't there.
Yeah. Occasionally I'll come across some, probably usually a tech or software related business. We have quite a number of small software companies that are born in Australia. But besides that, there's just so much more variety, I think, in the US market, especially for consumer goods, which is where I like to sit rather than banking or insurance or mining.
Yeah. That's Australia, isn't it? I say it all the time. It's holes and homes. Holes and homes. That's the Australian economy, folks. Holes and homes. It is. Anyway, do you have any ASX podcasts that you can think of, or
besides the ones you mentioned? I mean, I don't listen to any really at all.
Sorry, we can't be more helpful on that one. How about should I ask you this one? Maybe we can be more helpful on this question here.
Yeah.
Hi guys, this is going to be one for you, I think. Hi guys, I'm writing from Italy. Hello.
Hello
from Australia to all of our Italian listeners. I had a question regarding Texas Roadhouse. Texas Roadhouse's franchise partners plan. Sorry, Texas Roadhouse's franchise partners plan to open as many as 5 restaurants for 2022. My question is, do the partners spend their own money to open and build new restaurants, or does Texas Roadhouse somehow help them? Just trying to figure out how the company will spend this year in CapEx.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's a good question.
How much this company will you spend in CapEx? Sorry, I read it wrong.
Yeah, in terms of franchised restaurants, the partners are providing the capital upfront. So Texas Roadhouse has very, very little upfront capital that they need to put into opening franchise restaurants. And there's basically no ongoing cost for them as well. It's basically just a royalty structure. And that's, they don't talk too much about that in their annual report. Or they certainly don't talk about it in every annual report because it's not the main way that they do business. Most of the time, they're opening company-owned restaurants. And if you look at their CapEx, where they're spending CapEx is almost entirely on the expansion or renovation of company-owned restaurants. And they break down all of those numbers, which is great. The pre-opening costs and the cost of the land and the cost of the building and everything that goes into building those company-owned restaurants, which is where the bulk of their CapEx goes to. So
with the, you know how we went to one of the Texas Roadhouse owned by, what was his name? Willie Nelson.
Yeah.
Is that like a franchise agreement?
I don't know about that specific one. It could
maybe
be.
That's a special case.
It could be, yeah. I'm not sure.
He's pretty high profile.
Off the top of my head, I think they did have some kind of special arrangement with him. But right. In general, anyway, most of their franchise restaurants are operated by like 5 or 6 franchisees. So it's a very kind of limited. It's not like a McDonald's model where there's a lot of franchisees. They've got like a few partners that they really trust, and when they're testing restaurants in new markets, they offer them the opportunity to expand their own kind of little network of restaurants that they own. So,
right.
Yeah.
Cool. There you go. Well, that will do us for today, guys. Thank you very much for listening. Of course, if you have a question and you would like to send it in to us, just head over to YouTube. If you haven't watched the podcast on YouTube, then give it a go, because we're now recording every episode with video. So if you'd like to actually watch us have a chat as well as just hearing the audio, then head to YouTube, you know, or just listen to it on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, you know, do whatever. Yeah. I'm just glad you're here. but no, if you want to ask a question, just go over to the latest podcast on YouTube and just drop us a comment, and we'll chuck it in. All right. Very well done, Hamish Hodder. Hamish, Hames.
Hames, Hamish.
Whatever you're feeling this
Hamish.
Week. Hamish. Hamish. Order for Hamish. Anyway, that was so funny.
Instance. Oh, boy.
Oh, I'm looking forward to next year's trip already.
Yeah, I'm not we'll looking to forward planning. To that, but I'm looking forward to the trip, yeah.
You're looking forward to the trip. anyway, that's where we'll wrap it up for today, guys. Thank you very much for listening, /watching, /following, /everything. We love you all. We'll see you next week.
See you guys.